Bondurant.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, the judgment of the District Court has to be reversed for a whole series of reasons. First, as is apparent from the judgment, the District Court applied a higher standard of review at the pleading stage that would not even apply at the summary judgment or the trial stage.
Mr. Bondurant, what, if any, difference do you see between a Rule 12b-6, which is the old equity sort of demurra, and Rule 12b-6 as far as the different procedure or the different consequences of assuming all facts is true, which we do for both?
There is no difference between a 12b-6 motion and a 12c motion.
Why do we have them then? Why do we have two of them?
I think you'd have to ask the advisory committee, but I don't mean to be flip about that, but in either case, the rule is the allegations of the complaint are taken as true. Whatever is asserted in the answer, unless it admits the allegations of the complaint, is treated as false. The allegations of the complaint are construed in favor of the plaintiff, given the most favorable interpretation reasonably possible, and against the motion. The standards are, in fact, the same. And if we look at the controlling case law, for example, for jurisdictional purposes under Lujan, all that is required is a general allegation of proximate cause and injury in order to establish standard under 8A1. Under 8A2, which is worded exactly the way 8A1 is, a short, plain statement of the claim is required. And the Supreme Court has held, and this Court has held, that you do not have to allege as a plaintiff the essential elements of a claim, a prima facie case. And in Erickson, you had conclusory allegations of proximate cause in a prisoner 1983 case. And the Court again reversed the Court of Appeals in holding that all was required was a general allegation of proximate cause. The allegations are presumed to be true. They're construed in favor of the pleader. And as long as you comply with the notice pleading standard, giving the defendant notice of the claim, you have complied with 8A1 or 8A2. And that is essentially this case. In this case, the district court said, among other things, and he's dealing only with a motion, that to recover, Oceanic had to prove what would have happened in the absence of a bribe to a high degree of probability. There is no support for that proposition at any stage in any RICO case or in any other case other than a case governed by 9B at the pleading stage or at the summary judgment stage. Secondly, it is perfectly clear he did not believe the allegations of the complaint. How much more disparaging?
Judge Elrod had a question.
I apologize. You said that there's no standard like that, but in the Zervos case, it says that the proximate cause has to be so significant and important that the defendant should be held responsible. How is that different than high degree of probability? I understand it's not 12B.
It has to be significant, but that is merely a restatement of the Zenith standard and the standard that was applied in Phoenix Bond. As long as the RICO violation is a substantial contributing factor to the injury, it does not have to be the sole cause of the injury. That is all that is being said in those cases. In this case, the proximate cause allegations were, if anything, prolix. It was not alleged once. It was alleged about 20 different times in the complaint in 20 different ways. That because of the bribe, Oceanic was denied fair consideration for a bid that, guess what, was ultimately awarded to Conoco on terms even more favorable than they had under the 1991 concession agreement between the occupying power, Indonesia, and Australia, that which Al-Qatari described as a contract between an occupier and a thief.
Counsel, what is the relevance for your Rule 12 analysis of your first complaint? Can we consider that? And if not, I mean, is it abandoned for the purposes of this analysis? And are we, or can we consider any of the facts pled there?
It is essentially irrelevant for the purpose of this analysis.
If they're relevant.
The second amended complaint we have to live or die on. And the allegations, if accepted as true, establish proximate cause. The controlling case, and it's certainly not the only one, but if you look at Kirkpatrick, this very issue came up in the Court of Appeals, in which the defendant contended in the bribery of Nigerian officials on a construction contract that the plaintiff could not establish injury or proximate cause either for purposes of RICO or for purposes of Section 2C of the Robinson-Patman Act. The Court of Appeals rejected both. It went to the Supreme Court on a different issue, but had they been right, there would have been no reason to write a very lengthy opinion on the active state doctrine, in which the court ultimately concludes that you do not have to invalidate the act of a foreign state in order to hold someone who pays bribes to officials of a foreign government liable for treble damages under RICO or under the Robinson-Patman Act. The Phoenix Bond case, we believe, essentially establishes a series of propositions that are dispositive here. First, it repeats what we all know, that the allegations of the complaint must be accepted as true. Secondly, in Phoenix Bond, you had multiple victims suing as plaintiffs. Thus, the theory that there could be only one single victim of a RICO violation was explicitly rejected. The court said specifically that the act provided a remedy to, quote, any person injured by the violation. Third, the court held that the injury is direct if it was foreseeable and applied, among other things, the restatement standards in coming to that conclusion as well as prior cases. And fourth, it held that the denial of a competitor of an economic opportunity is the proximate cause of a compensable injury. And let's talk about Phoenix Bond because its facts are interesting. What you had there was what the Supreme Court called a zero-sum game, in which in auctions for land in Chicago, the practice was for bidders to bid the exact amount of the taxes with zero penalty to be paid by the taxpayer. In the event of tie bids, the bids on a particular piece of property were to be awarded on a rotational basis. The conspiracy among the defendants was to defraud the city of Chicago into believing they were bidding independently when, in fact, they were affiliated companies, thus defeating the single bidder rule. The city of Chicago was not injured other than being defrauded out of being able to enforce its own rule. It suffered no monetary harm because the amount that a tying bidder would pay is the amount of the taxes. And the amount would be paid the same whether paid by the defendants or paid by some other company. When you get to the plaintiff's injury, the court held all that was required is that the fraud on the city foreseeably would cause injury to the other bidders. Well, let's look at the other bidders in terms of the dichotomy that the court posed in the district court. A particular bidder, and here you had multiple plaintiffs, would have to show that he was next in line for the property. So if there were five plaintiffs, only one would be injured in the ultimate proof of damage sense. The other four would not. Secondly, to prove monetary injury, he would have to show that the particular property that he was going to buy was not going to be redeemed by the property owner within the period for redeeming tax liens. Under Illinois law, I could come in if you foreclosed and sold a tax lien on my house. I could redeem the property and get my title back as long as I paid the taxes. And since the bids were for no penalty, all I had to do was pay my taxes. And if I paid my taxes within the period, I got my property back. And the person who bid on it by paying the taxes to the city of Chicago simply had a zero-sum game. What he paid the city, he got back from the property owner and would not have been damaged even if he had not gotten it. Thirdly, if the property owner didn't redeem the property, ultimate monetary damage would depend on being able to resell the property after you got a tax deed at a higher price than you paid for the taxes. In this real estate market, that is even more speculative than it was perhaps in earlier real estate markets. But all of those uncertainties went only to amount of damage, not fact of damage.
But in that case, didn't you automatically get it was based upon being in line for the bids? Whereas here, that's not the case. It's not the first one in line gets it. That's, we don't know that in this case.
You know, in Phoenix Bond, the facts are that if there were multiple tie bids, assume 10 for the same piece of property, then the person in next in line, which would mean whatever happened in a series of prior bids, out of those 10 would get it. But
right.
It means 9 others who bid on it would not. Yet many of the 9 others were plaintiffs, and many other of the 9 others were not plaintiffs, but were people who were excluded from being denied the fair opportunity.
But by bidding, you actually had a place automatically, whereas here, by bidding, you don't necessarily get anything from having bid.
That is true, but if you go to the applicable case law, where a defendant, and that is particularly true in a bribery case, as in the Nigerian bribery in W.S. Kilpatrick, where a defendant bribes the government to refuse to even consider or negotiate with you or to hold an auction at which you would have been allowed to bid, the defendant cannot say, I'm off free. I have no exposure. I have immunized myself. If that were the case, then a company that bribes to obtain contracts from a county government in Texas, a company that bribes to pay to get a seat on a COM board in Alabama, a company that bribes or an individual that bribes to get a Senate seat in Illinois would never have monetary exposure to the excluded competitors.
But what is the right to compete here? Where does the right to compete derive?
The right to compete is the right to have a bid considered.
What body of law gives that right in this context?
The federal laws that prohibit bribery, Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which is not a RICO predicate, but traveling abroad as part of a scheme of bribery is a RICO predicate. The Federal Corrupt Practices Act prohibits that. W.S. Kilpatrick's core theory of the case is that the plaintiff in that case had a right to fair consideration uninfluenced by illegal activity, illegal under our law, whether or not illegal under Nigerian law was irrelevant, and that gave rise to a RICO cause of action, and that also gave rise to a claim under 2C. Part of the claim arises under 2C. Read Henry Broach, footnote 6, Supreme Court of the United States, 1960. The whole purpose of the brokerage provision in 2C of the Robinson-Patman Act is to make a company that pays bribes liable in treble damages to injured competitors. And the corollary to that is injured competitors have a right protected by the federal antitrust laws and also by RICO to compete on a level playing field uninfluenced by bribes.
You've got about a minute and a half left. Cover why we should vacate the District of Columbia District Court on the in personam jurisdiction over the subs.
Many of the district court's rulings were premised on venue in the District of Columbia. When the court transferred it, it essentially became a new case in the Southern District of Texas. They should be reviewed. Others were based on the assumption that execution of a waiver of service and acceptance of service would not subject one to jurisdiction. That's simply wrong. And that those rulings should also be considered. But when you've changed the venue, you have changed the ground rules under which the District of Columbia ruled on those issues, and they should simply be remanded for reconsideration, as we suggest, before a different district judge. With the court's permission, I will reserve the remainder of my time.
All right, sir. Thank you. Ms. Phillips, Mr. Wachtell.
If it pleases the court, this case, I submit, is controlled by 3 different decisions of the United States Supreme Court, American General Contractors, Holmes, and Anzer. And I would note AGC and Anzer were pleading cases. decided on the face of the pleading. And in ANZA, the Supreme Court has emphasized, as the 11th Circuit pointed out in Williams, a case that they cite, that you should carefully scrutinize proximate cause at the pleading stage to see what the allegations are. Counsel says that you accept pleadings as true. You accept well-pleaded pleadings as true. You do not accept conclusions as true. You do not accept speculation as true, and you do not accept allegations that are contradicted by counsel's by the party's own admissions in the court below. And that's what you have.
Now, wait. We're looking at a 12C.
Yep.
We assume the facts pleaded are true.
Well pleaded.
I'm not even sure that's correct for 12C, but as Judge Hughes said, I accept facts as true.
Yes.
Now, what are you talking about? Admissions in district court would contradict the facts in a complaint. Give me an example in this case.
Australia. In order to show the chain of causation between the claimed bribery, which Judge Hughes indeed accepted as true for purposes of the motion, and I should say 12C and 12B6 are identical standards, Your Honor. I don't think there's any question about that. Judge Hughes accepted the bribery and said, now under ANZA Holmes AGC, we have to look to see whether there is proximate cause chain between the claimed wrong and the claimed injury. And when you look here, the claim of bribery is that but for the bribery, they would have ended up owning these concessions in the Timor Gap.
Well, I'm not sure. I think they said they would have had an opportunity to bid, but
that is not the test with respect to
Keep going on your admissions that I asked you about.
Okay, but just let me note, placeholder, that is not the test. It is not the opportunity. That is not what the case law says. In fact, in ANZA, it is very, very specific, and also in Phoenix Bond, it is very, very specific. You have to show damages. Opportunity isn't damages if you weren't going to win. But the admission, let's take Australia. There is no allegation in this complaint whatsoever that Australia, under any circumstance, would have gone along to abrogate the prior concessions and put them up for rebidding, even if East Timor had wished to do so. No allegation. And there is an explicit concession in their brief below that this would not have happened. They tried to bury it in a footnote. I think it's on page 11 of their brief below. They tried to bury it in a footnote, and they say Australia's interests were aligned with those of ConocoPhillips. Australia was in favor of maintaining the status quo. I respectfully submit, if there was nothing else here whatsoever that irrefutably breaks any conceivable chain of causation between the supposed bribery of people in East Timor and the concept that these people could have, whether it be opportunity, Your Honor, or success, doesn't make any difference. There never would have been a new round of bidding because these concessions lie in territorial waters claimed by Australia. And there is no allegation in this complaint. They try in their brief before you to give short shrift to this and say, oh, well, East Timor perhaps could have abrogated all by itself. But this is frivolous. There is no allegation that Australia would have gone along. And as I say, there is a concession that it would not have. And there is no allegation that anybody could have operated this drilling and extraction procedures, this multi-billion-dollar project, in waters claimed by Australia without Australia's consent and over Australia's objections.
Is the only place where the claimed concession is the footnote that says that Australia was allied with Conoco?
Yes.
Is that the only, that's what you're calling
that is the concession. But there's also just an absence of any allegation. Nowhere. They have the burden to establish proximate cause, each of the steps along the chain, from claimed injury, from claimed wrongdoing to claimed injury. Here there is a total absence of any allegation that Australia would have gone along, even if East Timor so desired. No allegation is linked whatsoever, putting apart the admission. And even as to East Timor, they egregiously misrepresent the record. And I say that, I know those are strong words, but they egregiously misrepresent the record. They assure this court that the new East Timor constitution abrogated all prior existing concessions, including ConocoPhillips.
Is that in their second amended complaint?
Excuse me?
Is that in their second amended complaint?
Yes, because in the second amended complaint, they reference, although they do not give you the terms of the treaty that was entered into that same day after the new constitution went into effect between East Timor and Australia. They recognize in the complaint that the Constitution abrogated those concessions which were not thereafter confirmed. They then repeatedly reference the treaty, but do not tell you what it says. But when you read the treaty, which we put before the court below, both as a matter of judicial notice and as a matter of a document that was integrally referenced in the Second Amended complaint itself, when you read the treaty itself, you find that it expressly confirms the validity of the prior concessions and says they were ongoing. You just substitute now East Timor for the prior party of the...
Isn't that the basis of their complaint, that it was because of the alleged bribe that this happened?
No. They do not say that, Your Honor, and frankly, even if they had, that would be contradicted by the record itself. But we don't have, because there had been, long before this bribery scheme even started, it is indisputable that East Timor was committed to...
Now, we've got to stick within the four corners of the second amended complaint. That's what struck me about your brief, that you had 7 or 8 pages about all these facts that are historical facts laid out in your complaint about what was actually happening, which we can't consider.
Some you can, but frankly, if you ignored all of them, it would make no difference whatsoever.
Well, why did you put them in your brief?
Because, Your Honor, frankly, these people came forward under the cloak of privilege and made a scurrilous allegation of a $2 million bribe in cash by the CEO of our corporation. And we believed that putting the context of this and showing how highly implausible that allegation is something that it was necessary to do on this record. And we told the court below,
you didn't say in your brief, we have to do this because of this serious charge. You said, well, we know you can't consider this, but I think you might find
Your
it
Honor, most of those facts are properly in the record in any event. You have the exchange of notes back in 2000 between the United Nations entity, which was highly represented by the East Timor independence people who participated in that, and Australia, pre any allegation of bribery, that the concessions would be continued. You have an allegation in the second amended complaint in which they reference a letter that was sent by the independence leaders to ConocoPhillips. They say you should ignore it, but they reference it in the complaint. What does the document itself say? They never tell you what the document says. This is referenced, so it is properly before the court. The document says, concession people have no fear whatsoever. We are not going to be changing anything, pre any allegation of bribery. But you can ignore all of that. This matter stops with Australia itself. Because whatever happened in East Timor, Australia is a dead end for their claim. They never alleged Australia would go along. They concede it would not. This is in Australian claim territorial waters, and there is no claim that anybody could have proceeded here to do anything without Australia. And
how could we reach that conclusion based on the four corners of the Second Amended complaint?
Acknowledge in the complaint that this is a disputed territorial thing. There is no everybody.
It is between East Timor and Australia.
That's right. And Australia is claiming these territorial waters.
As is East Timor.
Sure. But East Timor, and there's no claim in this complaint that East Timor conceivably could defy Australia, that it could act unilaterally, that it permits somebody to drill. Australia has a navy.
I understand that, but that's extra record, though. Again, that's extra pleading, isn't it? I mean, those are common sense geographical facts.
Where is that in the
Second Amended?
It is in the Second Amended complaint.
Australia has a navy and could defeat East Timor.
Take judicial notice of that? For all I know, East Timor has a wonderful navy. I have no earthly idea.
The Second Amended complaint.
See, what you want us to do is take the Second Amended complaint and just go off on, no pun intended, a fishing expedition and research what sort of navy East Timor has, research what sort of claim Australia has.
Your Honor, I was simply asking a question. But the answer is right in the Second Amended Complaint. There's the allegation this is disputed territorial waters and they are claimed by Australia. And there is zero allegation, zero. This is on the stay right with the face, second face of the Second Amended Complaint. There is zero allegation in the complaint that anybody could proceed here without Australia. In their brief, they say, oh, well, East Timor could abrogate. They don't say East Timor could have its own bidding. They don't say Australia could go along with it. They concede Australia could not. I'm staying now strictly with the Second Amendment complaint. They're not going one iota beyond it, not even asking for judicial notice, even though judicial notice is appropriate on a motion of this nature. But just on the face of the complaint, there is no allegation that this could be done unilaterally, whatever East Timor wanted to do. They don't claim it, and it is patently not the case. And, Your Honor, going back to the question of opportunity, the law is not opportunity. They cite to a case which quotes the argument of a party from the Supreme Court that the issue is opportunity. But then, when the Phoenix Bond, but when you get to the court's opinion, not where they're just citing the party's contention of opportunity, when you get to the court's opinion, the court is very explicit that the test is would they ever obtain the liens.
Well, assuming there was a bribe, and again, we take the facts as pleaded, and they claim this, why would they possibly be able to have won the bid in that East Timor had already accepted a bribe and therefore would make sure ConocoPhillips got the job? I mean, what? You know, this idea of wanting us to try this case at this stage, we can't do that.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm really not understanding Your Honor's question. Let's assume there was a bribe.
Right.
You then have to say, would the bribe have resulted in the injury that they claim?
Exactly.
And the injury that they claim in their complaint, if you look at paragraph 1 of their complaint, the injury that they claim is that they would have had the drilling, that they would have won, that but for the bribe, that is what would have happened. It's right in paragraph 1 of the Second Amended Complaint. And you then have to ask yourself, what are the steps? And the logical steps are, would there have been an abrogation of the previous concessions? And the answer to that is clearly no, because they never alleged that Australia would have gone along with that, and they concede it would not. Even if East Timor would have, but for the bribe. Then the next step is, and, you know, these are highly speculative, conclusory allegations, they would have bid, even though historically they had never bid before. They would have had the wherewithal to bid, purely conclusory. No factual allegations whatsoever. And Twombly, putting aside the special scrutiny that the Supreme Court in ANZA says you have to bring to bear at the pleading stage in one of these proximate cause cases. And ANZA also says you should look with special care when you have a competitor claim. And here you have a putative competitor claim. But in any case now, under Twombly, you do not credit conclusory allegations.
I have a question. Do we have to find that Twombly applies to RICO cases as well as antitrust cases for you to prevail today?
I think in Ray Katrina, this court held that applies to everything.
In January, we said we were withholding whether it applied in RICO, and we would not reach that case.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I think Twombly applies, and any number of circuits now have held that Twombly applies to every species of case.
Do we have to hold that Twombly applies, or could we just find under the regular?
You do not have to hold because you find precisely the same requirements in ANZA. It cannot be speculative. It cannot be conclusory. You look with special care to proximate cause. You look with special care to claims by competitors. So, containing. They would have had the wherewithal to bid. They would have decided to bid. They would have had the wherewithal. They would have been qualified to bid. And there is this legal doctrine, which we have pointed out in that brief, and we pointed out in the 28J letter, this recent decision, Squalian Point from the Third Circuit, that as a matter of law, you do not deconstruct the decision-making of governmental bodies because you simply do not know what makes governments act.
So then and you can never have a claim for a bribery of a government official.
That may well be. That may well be, Your Honor, and if that's so,
that's so because there is no precise analog, nor is one intended by Congress, between a civil RICO case and a criminal RICO case. You have extra added requirements and essential elements that Congress applies to civil RICO, which do not apply to criminal RICO. Proximate cause and injury to person and property. So you're going to have any number of cases that are going to arise. If you look at the predicate acts under RICO, a lot of them have to do with attacks on the person, prostitution, injury, so on. You're never going to get a civil, or never or rarely going to get a civil RICO case because of the requirement of business and property. And in AGC itself, the court explicitly held that there is no, we are not saying that you need to have a specific plaintiff just because you have a violation of the antitrust laws. And that has been repeated thereafter. For example, in Aragon, the Ninth Circuit decision in Aragon, it was a tobacco case, Your Honor, the Ninth Circuit pointed to that holding in AGC, and of course the same is true of Holmes, because Holmes adopts the identical statute for RICO, identical standards for RICO, as AGC applied to the antitrust, and says you do not necessarily need, it is not a best plaintiff analysis. It may well be that there is no plaintiff. And the Steamfitters case in the Third Circuit holds exactly the same thing, and each of those was in, Texas Carpenters is not in our brief, I apologize, but each of those, the Texas Carpenters case, I think it's in 199 Third Circuit, specifically says Aragon laborers and Steamfitters are decided correctly, and we rely upon them. Even in the constitutional context of standing, if Your Honor please, the Supreme Court has been very, very explicit in, I'm trying to think of the name of the case, in holding, I can give you the name of the case in a moment, but the Supreme Court has been very, very explicit in saying the fact that there may not be a plaintiff who can meet the standard of constitutional standing to attack conduct of government does not mean that you therefore create one. And that is the specific holding in both antitrust and RICO of both AGC and Holmes. If there is no plaintiff with standing, proximate cause, no plaintiff who can satisfy the requirement of proximate cause, so be it. Right. There need
now,
not be in civil
in personam jurisdiction, and don't get into the they waived it because they didn't raise it in district court. Just address the in personam jurisdiction assertion.
I think Judge Sullivan had it correctly, and it doesn't make any difference. Because if you have these 15 or 20 other subsidiaries, they are barred by the same doctrine of proximate cause as bars the two plaintiffs who are the appellants here. So it is, I respectfully submit, totally academic. If I can say, this is not...
Address their claims that, well, that may not have been true in the District of Columbia. That may have been true. But the venue change makes it a whole new ball game now that it's in the Southern District of
Columbia. Well, there clearly is waiver because they never raised it.
No, sir. That was the, well. That's a question. I told you we can figure that one out. Just tell me the.
It makes no difference. It simply makes no difference because even if you had 15 other people here with jurisdiction, they are barred by proximate cause.
No, I understand that, Mr. Wachtel.
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Is there jurisdiction in the Southern District of Texas? If not, why not?
I think conceivably there might be.
Thank you.
But I think it's academic. If I can make the point, Your Honor, and we get to the question, would they have won? Purely conclusory, purely speculative, the Seventh Circuit in James Cape says you can never be sure somebody have won. And their reliance, this case could not be more different than Phoenix Bond. And Phoenix Bond does not change ANZA or Holmes. It starts off by saying, unlike ANZA and Holmes, and then ticks off a number of factors, and there is no conceivable one of the, they say, there's no other victim. Here, there is another victim, East Timor. Just as in ANZA, the primary victim was New York State. The competitor was, if anything, a collateral victim, and the Supreme Court said, that doesn't work. Here, if there's a victim of the bribery scheme, it is East Timor. And if you go down the factors in the case of Phoenix Bond, it could not be more unlike the present case. If I could finally say one thing, Your Honor, this is not a penumbral case.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honor, for your patience.
Thank you. Mr. Bondurant.
With all deference to Mr. Wachtel, our complaint in paragraph 88 alleges, and this addresses the Australia issue, quote, the new East Timor Constitution vitiated all prior exploration, production, or property interest in the Timor Gap, including the ConocoPhillips defendant's interest in all production-sharing contracts. In paragraph 88, it then quotes the East Timor Constitution, paragraph 158, which says precisely that. That constitution repudiated, among other things, the Portuguese concession to Oceanic in 1974 and repudiated the occupying Indonesian government's agreement with Australia with ConocoPhillips that it was later ratified after the constitution was adopted was the result of the bribery scheme, which is precisely the point you made, Judge Barksdale. The question that you asked Judge Elrod about Quambly, this court has said in multiple cases, and including opinions which every member of this panel has participated in, that the rule that comes out of Quambly is essentially that as long as the allegations rise beyond the level of the speculative, it cannot be dismissed on motion.
Address the point made that, contrary to what all of us like to think, that where there's a wrong, there's a remedy, that perhaps there's not a civil remedy, even though there might be a criminal remedy for bribery of this sort of alleged bribery.
Well, he's simply wrong as a matter of law. W.S. Kilpatrick is a case in the Supreme Court of the United States in which a competitor in exactly the position of Conoco bribed Nigerian officials to get a construction contract. At the Court of Appeals level, the precise arguments that he makes were raised and squarely rejected. It went up, admittedly, on the act of state doctrine, and Judge Scalia ruled that you did not have to invalidate the action of the Nigerian government, just as we don't have to invalidate whatever agreement has been subsequently reached between Australia and East Timor in order to hold someone who pays bribes liable. You have the same issue in Beter against Bloomquist, in which you had bribes to a mayor and several members of the city council, in which the argument was made very much here. It's the deconstruction argument. Unless you prove you bribed everybody in the whole government, from soup to nuts, you cannot have a claim. The court rejects that because of the influence that a single individual in lobbying behind the scenes, even if they had recused themselves, can exercise in this process.
Counsel, I'm concerned because although it appears that you reference Australia at least 18 times in your second amended complaint, I mean, different 18 different paragraphs, there's not a paragraph that says Australia might have acquiesced. There's no the argument that Australia would have gone along or might have gone along or anything. And, in fact, it shows that Australia is hostile and that there's even allegations of wanting to sue Australia in paragraphs 105 and 111.
Let me address it two ways. Number one, we don't have to negate a defense in the complaint. Number two, Australia's consent in going along was not required. This territory is called the East Timor Gap for a reason, and that is because there has never been an international treaty establishing the maritime boundary between East Timor and Australia.
We understand that. Now, it's claimed that you made some sort of concession in district court that we can consider in ruling on a Rule 12C about Australia. What is your recollection of the claimed concession?
There is no such concession. Essentially, that it is a statement of the obvious, that it was in Australia's self-interest, financial interest, to continue this contract and get a share of the royalties. But the essential part of that is the bribery to East Timor to get them to agree to that new treaty with Australia. Our position is, if there had been no bribes, East Timor would not have awarded this contract in agreement with Australia to Conoco on terms that the complaint alleges are more favorable to Conoco than were the 1991 or 2 concession they had from the joint authority. The assertion that the complaint does not allege that Oceanic had the wherewithal is simply untrue.
Well, that's beyond the point. I was trying to pinpoint. So where are we going to find this supposed concession in the record of the hearing before Judge Hughes? Is it in your brief or in district court or what?
There's a footnote, and I'll be happy to find it or have Mr. Wachtel find it.
Just tell me what's in the footnote.
Candidly, I don't remember the brief in that total context.
All right. Thank you.
And I don't want to misrepresent what's there.
Right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you for your arguments.